what you see in the Israeli security establishment right now is a real concern that the more the Palestinian populace is drained of any hope on the horizon, the more likely it is that there is going to be a descent into violence.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sarah Wildman, FP's print editor, and you're listening to The ER. With me is Ben Soloway, FP's associate editor, and joining us in the studio is Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, an institute focused on advancing a mutually dignified resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Daniel previously headed up Middle East and North Africa programs at the European Council on Foreign Relations and at the New America Foundation. But Daniel's origins start not in our wonky think tank world, but at the negotiating table. He was a member of the official Israeli delegation to the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, both at Taba under Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Oslo B under the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Daniel and Ben, thank you for joining me. We've now come to the end of Donald Trump's first year in office, and in that time, it seems we've seen a fundamental shift in U.S. policy towards the Middle East generally and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more specifically. While Trump has promised to make the, quote, ultimate deal in the region and has then quickly set his own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as well as his former lawyer, Jason Greenblatt, on the task, late in 2017, he seemed to dramatically reset the terms of negotiations when he announced the U.S. would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and promised the U.S. embassy would soon be moved to the Holy City. The Palestinian leadership cried foul and announced the U.S. would no longer be seen as an honest broker in peace negotiations. And meanwhile, members of the Israeli leadership began talking openly about annexation of settlements in the West Bank. But even before Trump's controversial Jerusalem declaration, the U.S. president seemed to tweak American policy by appearing to question long-established dogma on what's known as the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That is, the creation of an independent Palestinian state alongside the Jewish one. The president worried doves in the region when he nominated an ambassador who was seen as a champion of the settlements themselves, and Trump seemed to waver as well on whether the presence and growth of settlements in the West Bank had any impact at all on the future of peace. Daniel, was the two-state solution alive even before Trump took office? Have these motions changed the negotiations, and is it alive now?
I think things that have been done by human agency can be undone by human agency. We're not talking about someone who's dead and can't be resurrected. So it's not an exact science whether two states is irretrievable or retrievable. I think what one can say is that the direction of travel is to make a mutually acceptable two-state outcome ever less likely, given the Israeli settlement policy, given the degree of Israeli control, and the other things that we've been following over the years. There seemed to be an American commitment to a certain outcome which was backed up by UN resolutions, was backed up by an international consensus, had occasionally come close to an agreement in negotiations between the parties, and that was a certain two-state outcome based on what are called the 1967 lines. Jerusalem would be the capital of two states. There would be perhaps minor land swaps, some addressing of the Palestinian refugee question. Previous U.S. administrations conspicuously did not use the leverage they have on Israel, and these are not two symmetrical parties. There's an occupying power and an occupied people. So throughout the peace process, America could never carry Israel over the finishing line. But there was at least a common sense of what the end game might have to look like. That has fundamentally changed under the Trump administration, the Jerusalem move being the most dramatic manifestation of that fundamental change. Now, it may be that things can be pulled back, at least in terms of the goal, to the status quo ante. But it could also be that the Trump administration now acts as an accelerant, puts its foot on the accelerator of those very trends which were making two states more unlikely anyway. And I think there is one group, at least, for whom They are in a hurry, and the Trump administration is all about making as irreversible as possible the eclipse of the two-state option, and that is the Israeli right, who seem to share an agenda with, I think, the most dominant actor in the Trump administration on this file, the ambassador to Israel, who you referred to earlier, who has a history of support for the settlements, David Friedman.
You were in the room when the negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians seemed closest. What happened to derail it at that moment? And what would it have taken then to reach that agreement? And what sort of American leadership, how much did the American leadership actually make a difference at that time?
I think America has made a difference. When the so-called final status issues, the issues that would have to be closed in order to reach a two-state deal, were addressed under President Clinton, if people remember, there was the Camp David summit in July of the year 2000, Ehud Barak, Yasser Arafat. I wasn't there, but I think there you saw, despite the goodwill, the American peace team getting it wrong and being too willing, as one of the team, Aaron Miller, later wrote in his book, to be Israel's lawyer. Only later on that year did the Americans put out a plan, which was known as the Clinton Parameters, around which we negotiated, where I did participate at Taba. The Americans weren't there. And I think it's far from inevitable that we would have reached an agreement at Taba under other political circumstances. But the circumstances at Taba was that the Israeli prime minister was already a political dead man walking. We were 2 weeks away from an election, which the polls so categorically saw him as losing that he pulled back, actually, from those negotiations in the end. So both sides said we'd come closer than ever, and it was the Israeli side that put a stop to it. The other time we got very close—
Remind us what year that was.
This was in January 2001. So this is 6 months after Camp David. The second intifada is in full swing. The other time that one possibly got close was under Prime Minister Olmert. But again, this happens when Olmert is already politically finished, actually, in Israel. At no stage, though, and I think this is crucial, at no stage did you have an American commitment to use its political muscle to try and get the Israeli side to perhaps do things they wanted to do. Some Israeli leaders have been known to comment that it was almost like I wanted my hand to be behind my back for the Americans to carry me there. That's the only way I could do it and sell it. What you have today is fundamentally different, both in terms of the American approach and in terms of where the Israeli leadership is at. The current Israeli governing coalition has made absolutely clear that there is no reasonable two-state outcome that is at all in the ballpark of what was previously discussed and negotiated that they would accept.
Even though Netanyahu himself has said he would support a two-state solution, his coalition would not support it as it once looked.
Well, it's important to understand a few things on that, Sarah. As you say, Netanyahu has used the term two states and has suggested he would accept it and said as much. He's also said the opposite. So depending on what day you ask him, what audience he is in front of, he might say I'm for two states, or he might say there can't be a Palestinian state. It's a state minus, first of all. Second of all, this has never been adopted as the policy of the Likud, Netanyahu's governing party, or the policy of the Israeli government. It's interesting that the international community has demanded that Hamas, for instance, have to accept Israel, have to accept two states before they can be brought into any process. Not a demand made of Israel, not a demand made of the Israeli government, not a demand made of Prime Minister Netanyahu. I think Netanyahu's position on two states is the following, and I think it accords with the new administration in Washington. What we are offering the Palestinians, we, Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Israeli government, falls far short of what would normally be considered a state. And often he talks about state minus. It doesn't have actual sovereignty. It doesn't control its own security. It doesn't have territorial viability. It doesn't have control of its resources, etc., etc. If the Palestinians want to call what is essentially a Bantustan situation a state, then why should I be the guy who says, no, 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 it's not a state? So he is asking the Palestinians to call something that is not a state a state, and that he is willing to accept. The Israeli defense minister of recent times, who's no longer in that position but served under Netanyahu, Bugi Yalon, he actually said, look, if they want to call it the Palestinian Empire, they can call it the Palestinian Empire as far as I'm concerned. The truth is it won't be a state. So no, Bibi Netanyahu does not see Palestinian statehood in the terms in which anyone else would recognize it as such.
I think we're curious now that even the rhetoric of the two-state solution seems to have been largely abandoned. What are the various real end solutions that the stakeholders in play are now pushing for in absolute brief? What are the different ways forward possibly look like?
And before, I do want to note that Daniel used a term relating to South Africa that is considered controversial but has been used more and more by people on the left. And even today, we are in February, and today by the publisher of Haaretz. So, but you can continue.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. And that's where Trump as an accelerant is an interesting thing to be following. Very briefly, 1967 is... Let's just start with 67 rather than go back earlier. Israel takes control of these territories. For the first quarter of a century, Israel controls the territories with its military, sets up a civil administration. The Palestinians are still recovering from 67. Next quarter of a century, we have the Oslo management mechanism. Whether it was intended as such or not, Oslo creates a limited Palestinian self-government called the Palestinian Authority, that becomes co-opted as part of the status quo, and the territories are managed in this way without actual Palestinian freedom, independence, etc. And I think that era is drawing to a close. And the question is, what will be the next iteration of what happens in those territories? One option is, and I think it's the option that there is the broader consensus around in Israel, is for 50 years, one has created tools for managing this. We will find either a new tool for managing this, for managing the Palestinians without them having rights, or tweak the old tool. So I think that's the most likely, as Israelis see it, continued management. The logic of where this is going is to formalize an apartheid reality. Over a decade ago, you had Israeli former prime ministers Barak and Olmert saying the reason we have to have a Palestinian state is that if we carry on this way, it will become South Africa apartheid. A decade later, where the situation has got exponentially worse, it's very hard not to see a legitimacy in using that terminology. So one is a formalization, another is a formalization of apartheid. There is almost an expulsionist logic to the direction of travel. Because if you're going to permanently control those territories, but you don't want to give the Palestinians rights, then could you see a second expulsion of the Palestinians? Or Israel having created one political space, irreversibly so, do you see a Palestinian struggle for equal rights, a non-violent civil resistance movement, which is normally referred to as one state or one democratic state?
And I do want to point out again that these are controversial terms, especially in the American Jewish community, which rejects them for the most part.
I think Michelle Goldberg described this in a very useful way. She's a new New York Times columnist. She wrote a piece on the death of liberal Zionism. And she said, I'm paraphrasing here, supporters of Israel don't like it when the term apartheid is used. But how else do you describe a situation of separate and unequal, a situation where one group of people have one set of rights and another group of people a very different and secondary set of rights?
Let's move on. You talked about nonviolent civil disobedience in the Palestinian territories. And the story that's really dominated the headlines in Israel over the last few months is that of Ahed Tamimi, a 16-year-old girl who lives in the town of Nabi Saleh, who was captured on video slapping an Israeli soldier and was taken into custody. What do you think that story has really attracted the attention of Israelis? And what do you think the story tells? I mean, remember, this girl has grown up not in the first or second generation living in the territories, but really in the third, or I mean, maybe she's even the fourth at this point. She lives in a town which has argued over our water usage and land rights with a local settlement. And in a way, it seems like her story has come to embody something and take on an imagery that has had a lot of resonance in ways that other stories of civil disobedience have not. I wonder if what you think of the Tamimi story and why Israelis have paid attention to it, and what you think the message is of this girl's sort of small act having, you know, bigger waves.
Well, as you say, this is a Palestinian village in Abi Saleh. Land has been confiscated by settlements. Olive groves have been taken. And they've led a non-violent struggle. The Tamimi family is a large family. The village and the family largely overlap. Members of her family have been killed. Other members have been imprisoned. The immediate backdrop to the incident with the soldiers was her cousin getting shot. It was a photogenic situation. But I think what it more importantly speaks to is that it will resonate with Americans, the power of nonviolent civil disobedience, civil resistance. I don't think one can call slapping a soldier an act of violence when one thinks of the violence committed by the heavily armed Israeli side on members of her village and her family. And what that tends to be is you hold up a mirror to your oppressor. Now, I don't think it's had a dramatic effect in Israeli society, but you multiply what Ahed Tamimi did day in, day out, tenfold, weeks, months, holding up that, the inevitability of the violent response, holding up that mirror, and perhaps enough Israelis will humanize Palestinians in a way that they have been so dehumanized in Israel for so long. There is, which this also is a part of, there is a terrible abuse that goes on with Palestinian child detainees. And I think the comparison also has to be drawn to the way Israeli Jewish settler children and Israeli Jewish right-wing activists especially are treated, are handled, when they are violent with Israeli soldiers, when outposts are occasionally removed, or when soldiers interpose themselves between Israelis who are sometimes burning Palestinian olive groves. What has happened to Ahed Tamimi never happens to those settler children under similar circumstances.
I do want to point out that there have been a series of dramatic stabbings as well in the West Bank. So it's not only nonviolence.
Nabi Saleh is known for the nonviolent struggle. The Ahed Tamimi case is a case par exemple of nonviolence.
Thanks for clarifying that. Is there any other actor on the world stage who could step in as mediator given this current questions around the U.S. role? And who would that be? Would it be Germany? Would it be the European Union? Is there somebody else that could step in and play a role as a mediator between Israelis and Palestinians that is not doing so, that would like to do so, or is that sort of pie in the sky hope?
To follow up on that, can you speak to the narrative that the U.S. has abdicated from its position as mediator under Trump?
I don't think there is anyone with the appetite or who would be accepted by the Israeli side to be an alternative mediator. There was an attempt 15 years ago to circumvent in some ways or augment American exclusivity, American monopoly. A body called the Quartet was established, which included Russia, the representative of the UN Secretary General, the European Union, and the Americans. That went nowhere. It was largely dismissed by the Israelis. So I don't think the issue really is, does one need an alternative mechanism? I think the answer to the alternative to the Americans, when the American position has largely self-marginalized in terms of actually achieving a deal, is the parties themselves, and especially the agency on the Palestinian side, who they're not going to have their freedom handed to them. People struggle for their freedom, and people on the outside tend to mobilize more actively when they see a struggle that they want to identify with, not just a plight. that they want to identify with. What you have seen, which is significant, is a U.S. position, which I think the Israeli governing coalition sees as a win-win. Either the Americans try through financial threats, other threats, and through some financial inducements that are being dangled, either they get the Palestinians to basically drop their national aspirations, drop their aspiration to being fully enfranchised citizens of some state, and they get the Palestinians to embrace this apartheid reality, or in not doing so, you blame the Palestinians.
Do you see any option where, I mean, now, you know, John Kerry, right before he left office, warned of a one-state reality forming. And that concept, that phrase, has been used a fair amount. And obviously, his idea of a one-state reality was not a positive one. Is there any one-state positive solution where everyone's a citizen?
I don't know.
Is that something anybody would want?
Does it work in America? You have people of different ethnicities and they all are citizens of one country. I say that somewhat facetiously. It is clearly not an outcome that the vast majority of Israelis want. But the dynamic on the Palestinian side is different, but one should also acknowledge that the Palestinian National Movement wants an independent state. It doesn't want to share one state with the Israelis. You look at the polling and more Palestinians, especially younger Palestinians, are saying that one state with equality is not just the fallback for many of them, it's actually the preferred option. You don't go overnight from two states to one state. The direction of travel is that two states is becoming impossible.
Hasn't the majority of polling among Israelis always been that the vast majority of people would like two states still, even if the leadership has moved in a different direction? Or is that still not true?
It's very wobbly because once you dig into the details, it doesn't come close to what is necessary. It doesn't mean it can't be done. As I said at the very beginning, what has been done can be undone.
I know you're short on time, and I don't want to keep you too long, but I'm curious about two more things. We've gone in a tough direction. I want to know, does rhetoric matter? I mentioned at the beginning that Trump has changed language. He talked at the beginning of his administration about whether or not settlements were an obstacle to peace. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. Maybe they're not helpful, he said at some point. I'm paraphrasing. Does rhetoric matter, and what happens with that kind of messaging, and how does that affect the kind of place I want to get us to, which is the possibility of hope? We've talked about a number of dark options. And if we are talking about some possibility of a better future for both peoples, whatever that looks like, how does that kind of messaging help or not help? How does it hurt or not hurt? And really, if you could bring us to any place that is in any way hopeful, if you can't, then that's, I'm not going to force that.
The absence of hope is actually a contributing factor to insecurity. What you see in the Israeli security establishment right now is a real concern that the more the Palestinian populace is drained of any hope on the horizon, including because of the things done by the US administration, the more likely, whether individuals or in a more organized fashion, it is that there is going to be a descent into violence. Violence begets violence, etc. The policies are just as important as the rhetoric. So the policies of defunding UNRWA, which provides for Palestinian refugees, is also destabilizing. The Jerusalem move, the indulgence of the most unreasonable of the policies on the Israeli side. The hope is that on the Palestinian side, hopelessness actually translates into an abandonment of failed strategies and a way of asserting in a constructive, non-violent way their right to dignity, and that that in turn sets in motion a recalibration on the Israeli side. Because actually you need to respect your adversary in order to take them seriously and to rethink how you're positioning yourself vis-a-vis your adversary. And I think that that respect has been lost on the Israeli side for the Palestinian leadership for many different reasons. So I think that, you know, it's interesting. The peace process began off the back of the First Intifada. Now, the First Intifada, people tend to forget, was an unarmed intifada in very large measure. There's a film just been made, Nyla and the Uprising on the First Intifada. A group of Israelis were shown the film. Many of them were moved to tears because they remembered serving at that time and how powerful it was to be confronted by Palestinians demanding their rights in a non-violent way. It can bring out the best in people when you look and you say, I can identify with that. And I think that's not inconceivable. The journey that a lot of the Israeli body politic, and it's reflected in the population, has taken toward a very narrow ethno-nationalist sense of what kind of a country they want to be, how one treats the other, is not unique to Israel. There are journeys going on elsewhere in the world, in Europe, in parts of the United States. That doesn't mean that that's a linear journey in one direction that can't be turned around. And I think it can be turned around in many places, and it can also be turned around in Israel. And it may begin, and this I would leave you with as a hopeful thought, it may begin with the 20% of the Israeli population, I'm not talking about the occupied territories now, the 20% of the Israeli population who are Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel, whose rights are being more infringed now. There's legislation to curtail their rights further. They are pushing back. They are launching what looks increasingly like a civil rights struggle inside Israel. And that may find a resonance among the Israeli Jewish population in ways that could create new fault lines that then have a knock-on effect onto the Palestinians in the territories also.
How does that affect leadership? On both sides, there have been longtime leaders that people aren't happy with. And are you talking about a grassroots movement to change that leadership, or a grassroots movement that changes hearts and minds on the ground and ultimately sways the body politic?
One is related to the other. I think, yes, a leader can come along that galvanizes something that wasn't there before. But you can also have grassroots movements that then demand that a leader, that leadership be generated from that. I do think leadership is incredibly important. I think one of the most effective political assassinations in history, actually, was the assassination by a right-wing Jewish Israeli extremist of Yitzhak Rabin in 1995.
In derailing the peace process.
Very much so.
A few days after Daniel Levy left our studio and headed back to London, there was actually a significant development. In a year-long investigation into Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, the Israeli police recommended to the Attorney General of Israel that the prime minister be indicted on fraud, breach of trust, and bribery. So we put Daniel Levy back on the phone to ask, what does this impending indictment mean for Israel, and what might it potentially mean for the Israeli peace process and for Israel-U.S. relations?
Well, first one has to be clear on the process that will now be pursued. The police recommendation, although in many ways unprecedented, does not automatically translate into the Attorney General actually pursuing an indictment and a case against the sitting Prime Minister. That will take some months for the Attorney General to work through and make a determination. Assuming, which is not a given, the Attorney General did go through with an indictment, that would pose an immediate question and challenge for Netanyahu's own party and his own coalition. It is clear that his political allies have decided to stand with him despite the police recommendation, and that was known in advance.
And how do we know that? How do we know that? Who has said that exactly? Because my sense was that there were people waiting in the wings to kind of step in, though he said just on the 14th, Netanyahu said himself, quote, "The coalition is stable and no one, me or anyone else, has plans to go to elections." He continued, "We will continue to work together with you for the citizens of the state of Israel until the end of our term." And this was quoted in the New York Times on the 14th of February.
Right. So in advance of a very anticipated police recommendation, the heads of the other factions in Netanyahu's coalition had pretty much made clear that the police recommendation would not herald a reconsideration of their position in the coalition. They have not, and that is what they have followed through on. In the subsequent days since the issuing of the police recommendation, that has threatened to bolt the coalition. What they have not made clear is where they would stand in the wake of the Attorney General going through with the indictment, and that's some months off. So many things can happen. The exact nature of any indictment could have repercussions. One of the reasons they have stood with Netanyahu already is that Netanyahu has waged a very effective campaign during the investigation over the last year to hold the base of his own party and beyond his own party, because the different parties of the right in Israel compete for the same voters. That's what happens in a multiple party electoral system. He has managed to hold that base with him. And I think that will be the biggest question to look out for. Do the folks within his own party, do the leaders of the other coalition parties feel it is more politically sage for them to stand with Netanyahu or to go against Netanyahu? And so this is going to be a determination made on political electoral grounds, it seems.
Do you think that he has the support of the Israeli public as well as his coalition? And I want to note that also Sarah Netanyahu, his wife, there have also been rumors that she could be up for indictment.
Yeah, the charges against Sarah will be less significant. Sarah Netanyahu is not the prime minister. That's not going to bring down the government. Mm-hmm. It's part of the background noise. It's not insignificant, but it's not going to bring down the government. Like I said, Netanyahu maintains the support of his political base. Again, in a multi-party system, no party, and therefore no leader, gets anything approaching 50% of the vote. The Likud are the largest party in the Israeli parliament on a quarter of the vote. So that's the nature of the political dynamic, the system in Israel. But the crucial thing is he holds enough of the base together. This really shouldn't be difficult for an American audience to read. If you look at the state of affairs there, what holds so much of the Republican establishment with President Trump himself, the fact that he carries the base with him, they don't want to go against that. Like I say, there could be a principled stance on behalf of one or other coalition partners. People may feel that Bibi is losing his political edge. They may go against him, but that is far from a given. There's 2 years to go till elections. Netanyahu has different options. He could try and ride it out, or he could himself, in the wake of an indictment, precipitate an election, go to the public, ask for their renewed faith. If he were to win an election with that cloud of an indictment hanging, the pressure to drop the charges or to allow the entire legal process to continue while Netanyahu remains in office would be great. So it is to eulogize Netanyahu politically as premature, but this feels like the important crossing of a Rubicon from which it will be more difficult but not inconceivable for him to recover.
Before I let you go, you mentioned Trump, and actually this week on the 11th, on Sunday, President Trump had a conversation with Israel Hayom, the free right-wing daily newspaper that's handed out in Israel and funded by Sheldon Adelson, an American Republican casino magnate. He gave an interview where he actually seemed to change his tack again on settlements. Settlements, he told Israel Hayom, according to the New York Times, are something that very much complicates and always have complicated making peace. And the other thing that has been noted is that he hasn't actually made a robust statement supporting Netanyahu. And I wonder if you think that this is a shift or something we should be watching or maybe not paying attention to at all.
Yeah, not important in the least. It's about the weakest statement any president could possibly come up with on the settlements. I don't think there's a friction there. I think the deep ideological and political alignment between the Netanyahu government in Israel, the Trump administration in the U.S. absolutely stands strong. And you don't need Trump to come out, and it would be inappropriate for Trump to come out and defend the prime minister in the context of the issuing of a police recommendation for a charge. But I do think the American president, as we've seen in the past, and as is a two-way street, will find ways to embrace Netanyahu over the next period, with a small caveat that some on the Israeli right are beginning to feel that Netanyahu could become a liability and are getting ready to ditch Netanyahu for another rightist leader. That is by no means the majority feeling on the Israeli right. But if that did gather momentum, then one might see a change in the editorial line of Sheldon Adelson's newspaper. One might see a change in the messages coming through from the ultra-rightist American ambassador to Israel, appointed by Trump, Ambassador Friedman. So you could see that shift to support another right-wing figure, but I'm going way ahead of myself. That's not the space we're in now.
And one last thing, I mean, since we have called you for a bit of a follow-up, Ahed Tamimi, who we talked about earlier, has gone to trial. Any further thoughts on that case?
The Ahed Tamimi going to trial was the next step. That was to be expected. The significant thing that has happened is that the almost tongue-in-cheek determination of the military court has been that for her interest, the trial should be conducted away from the media, away from the cameras, no journalists present in the court. Clearly, that's not in her interest. And there's every expectation that that trial will move forward. The degree of attention, the fact that you're still following it and raising the issue, I think, again, demonstrates that the power in potential nonviolent civil resistance movement on the Palestinian side and Israel's vulnerability in the face of that.
If there was someone to come up on the right to challenge Netanyahu, who would it be? Naftali Bennett of the Israel Home Party? Who would it be?
It's unclear at this stage. The feeling is that a leader of a more factional party, a party not perceived as a national party, which is Naftali Bennett, that he wouldn't be able to offer an alternative national leadership. Were he the leader of the Likud, that might be different. Netanyahu has been the only leader of the Likud to serve as prime minister in an awfully long time. So there is going to be a serious jostling for position if and when we enter the post-Bibi Netanyahu era in Israeli politics. And it is very unclear at this stage who might emerge as a leader. And it may well be the case, as often happens in parliamentary democracies with strong political parties, that whoever it is who actually puts the knife in is not the person who people then rally behind. That person almost plays the role of a stalking horse. So we're a long way off that.
And I do want to note that Netanyahu has served as prime minister longer than anyone else other than David Ben-Gurion, who was Israel's first prime minister.
And he's inside of that. He's in sight of becoming the longest serving ever Israeli prime minister. I think that's a huge deal for him. It's a huge goal for him. When people ask, yeah, but surely Bibi wants to do something on peace, on something, legacy. No. If he could depart the political arena, and as far as he's concerned, ideally not to swap the prime minister's office for a jail cell. That would be a huge deal for him if he's the longest serving ever Israeli prime minister. That's the legacy.
Thanks again for checking back in with us. That was Daniel Levy of the U.S. Middle East Project speaking to us from London. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host. The podcast is produced by Shelby Bosted. For more information about foreign policy and to subscribe to The ER, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.